And there was...
Breaking news! Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth! People are exhilarated! And scared! Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down! My God! My God! They're beaming me up with them! Don't put that probe there! Don't put that probe there! Don't put a... Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 PM Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchard. Bringing you the High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Hi, everybody. The Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection. Keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit TheGalacticConnection.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
My name is James O'Connell, and I'm the founder of the Experiencers Alien Encounter Research Team. And yes, my extraterrestrial visitors told me to seek out others like myself and then look within. So we know they've left clues for us to unlock. Each experiencer may have a piece of this cosmic puzzle hidden in their subconscious memories, and this information is leading us on a scavenger hunt for the answers to this extraterrestrial phenomenon. Come along with us as we examine lives of ordinary people that are involved in extraordinary circumstances. Expect to experience the mystical, magical, and miraculous. Because where our team goes, alien encounters follow. This amazing journey begins with us because we are the Experiencers Alien Encounter Research Team from the John Mack Institute.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your... The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Scotty Roberts. We'll be discussing Scott Allen Roberts' books, which include, among others, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim and The Secret History of the Reptilians, as well as the Paradigm Symposium this October 18th through 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where Scotty will be a speaker and co-host. Websites referenced during this discussion will be scottallenroberts.com, intrepidmag.com, and paradigmsymposium.com. September 28, 2012 program is Scott Allen Roberts or Scotty Roberts. The Global Focus program is broadcast on the UPRN network, 107.9 FM, New Orleans. And tonight, the Galactic Connection with host Erica Getch follows this program with Erica's guest, Dr. Rita Louise. Don't miss the Galactic Connection. And thanks to Joe Montaldo for making these programs possible. On A Global Focus this evening, we welcome Scotty Roberts as a return guest. Scotty's first interview on the show this past March 16th to a record audience. Tonight's discussion topics will include the excellent books authored by Scott Allen Roberts, including The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim and The Secret History of the Reptilians, which will be released February 2013. Scotty also has authored and illustrated the adventure series, The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare, with his current project in that Tam O'Hare and the Banshee of Ballyglenmorough. Scotty also was a contributor to the book Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past. Also tonight, we'll be discussing the upcoming Paradigm Symposium this October 18th through the 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where Scotty will be a speaker and a co-host. I find Scotty's work gives very substantive support to the research of several of his peers, also speaking as guests at Paradigm Symposium. Scotty is the co-founder and publisher of Intrepid Magazine, a publication with an eclectic focus on science, politics, culture, ancient civilizations, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena. He is the former editor-in-chief of TAPS Para Magazine, the official publication of Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters. Also, I want to bring the attention of our network audience to the fact as well that Scotty has two recent excellent interviews on our UPRN network. First, it was Scotty's interview on the program debut of The Galactic Connection with host Erica Getch, and Scotty's interview on Second Sight New York City with co-host Stephanie Bonetti and Christopher George. Now, Scotty, I am thrilled to have you here as a guest. I know you have the bolt, but I can't wait to discuss those interesting topics this evening.
Oh, well, thank you. And thanks for having me again, Patrice. And yeah, as you mentioned, I've been getting over it's kind of funny. When I was a kid, getting a cold, and by kid, I mean, you know, college age, my 20s and my 30s, you get a bad cold, you roll with it. Now that I'm in my early 50s, I get a bad cold, and it kind of knocks me on my butt. And I've been like 3 weeks almost struggling with this chest and sinus cold, and I've just got a little hacking cough left, so I have no mute button on my phone, so you'll have to pardon me tonight if I cough up a lung into your microphone.
Well, nonetheless, it's wonderful to hear you this evening. And, you know, first of all, Scotty, you are uniquely credentialed to research the matter of the Nephilim, also known as the Watchers. You have thoroughly delved into biblical, archaeological, and ancient historical accounts.
Yes, I have. And it really started because when I was in my seminary days, I had questions about this stuff. And I would ask those questions. We were in a very conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical Baptist setting. And so these are the things that fell into that category of our faith was supposed to be on the practical level, which I understand. And all of this darker stuff, the weirder mysteries, if you will, of biblical topics, were things that were almost taboo. They were just things we didn't talk about. And if you brought it up, it was like dealing with skeptics. There would always be a good reason for why that didn't mean what we thought it might mean. And the Nephilim was one of those topics. And the more I asked questions about it, the more I was told I was, you're a troublemaker, you know, and it was either with a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we'll meet over coffee and talk about this because we can't talk about it here, or it was sincere. You better not dig into that stuff because you're going to get into the dark side of stuff and we just don't teach that here. So that's what I faced. And the more I started asking and looking into answers, the more I found more questions would rise. I mean, and isn't that just the way it is? It's like the more you think you know, the more you realize you don't know nothing. And the more you question and the more you doubt and question, the harder it is to land on one specific thing that fits into any, in my case, one specific religion. And so I drifted a bit away from that and started looking for other answers. And but I was going back to that source point, that biblical source point, which is where the story of the Nephilim is sourced. The word is sourced of the Hebrew Bible. And so I wanted to look that up and dig into it. And that's really what got me around to where I am now.
Excellent. Well, you know, Scotty, I can't wait to read your book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent in Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos, which will be available this February 2013. Scotty, do you believe the reptilians themselves represent an aspect of the Nephilim?
You know, I think that there's connectivity. I know that there are a lot of what I would call almost fantasy theorists in this field that have made direct linkages between the reptilians and the Anunnaki. And the Anunnaki is another one of those words like Nephilim that gets a lot of play in kind of ancient alien types of fields where they want to connect all these characters. And there is some connection, but then this reptilian factor is brought in. And something I found is that the serpent plays a great role in almost every ancient culture that exists on this planet. And it has down through the ages, and it's been a symbol of both good and evil in religions, ancient cultures, mythology. Even if you start looking in the modern day, just through very common symbols, we look at the medical caduceus, which you see on the I think it's the American Medical Association or something like that.
Yes.
The two serpents wrapped around the tree. And then the other would be things as simple as the don't tread on me rattlesnake that you saw on the colonial flags. There again, the serpent being representative of something. And so you see good and evil representations of this all down through history, even into modern iconography. And sometimes it's so simple we almost miss it.
Boy, those are very intriguing points there. And one question here, Scar, listeners who might not be familiar with the subject, could you give an explanation as to the significance of the term Nephilim? I believe you consider that the Nephilim information is actually encoded in the Bible. They're known as the Watchers, also the B'nai HaElohim.
Yes. Now, the first thing about the Nephilim, it's very easy to confuse them. The Nephilim are not the Watchers. The Nephilim are considered to be the offspring of the Watchers mingling with human women. The Watchers is not used that much in the Old Testament. You don't find that term very often. You find it in the book of Daniel with Nebuchadnezzar before his madness and things like this, that the Watchers came to him and revealed things. But more you see the Watchers connected to the Nephilim story in an apocryphal book, the Book of Enoch, which some people want to disregard because it's an apocryphal book. Well, the problem is that that was made an apocryphal book by Constantine's councils in the 300s, and they booted it out with several other books in the Bible, saying that we can't come to unanimous decision on whether or not this is scripture, so we're going to set it over here. But talks about the sons of God, the B'nai HaElohim, who came down and intermingled with the daughters of men. He refers to them as the Watchers. And then the offspring are the Nephilim. And Nephilim is sourced in, you find it in the Book of Enoch, you find it in a couple of obscure, what used to be old, lost books of the Old Testament, which have been found in Dead Sea Scrolls and so on. But the biggest reference you find is in the Book of Genesis. And it's right at the beginning of the Noah and the Ark story. It talks about, it says, and the sons of God intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. And they were known as the Nephilim, and they were the heroes of old and the men of renown. It says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward. And then the account ends, and it goes right into the account of the flood of Noah. And one thing I found as I was starting to compare all this, first thing I wanted to know was, who were the sons of God? And who were the Nephilim? These were the questions I asked. And in seminary, I was told this answer. Oh, well, they're obviously nothing other than just humans. The sons of God is a reference to the aristocrats who built the school of the prophets up on the hilltop, and that the sons of these aristocrats would go in a sense, slumming down into the valley villages, and they intermingle with the human women down there. And the Nephilim were just the heroes of old and the men of renown. Great warriors, the Giborim, as the Hebrew term calls them. A class of mighty warriors. Well, the problem I had with this, and I would bring this up to my professors, was you teach us in systematic theology that these words all mean something and language structure means something. And when you go to the context of these old passages, the way the Hebrew was written, the audience to whom it was written, their understanding of what was being said are all factors that play into deciphering what the meaning is. And I said, so when you say that the sons of God, the Bnei HaElohim, were actually sons of human aristocrats who founded the schools of the prophets, and that they went into the daughters of men, it says in the passage, the daughters of Adam, or of mankind, Adam being the word, and so there's a stark contrast there. It doesn't say the sons of Adam went into the daughters of Adam and had children and bore the Nephilim. It's under Elohim, which is one of the many names used for God in the Old Testament. As a matter of fact, the name used the most to represent God in the Old Testament, almost 3,000 times. And so it's saying the Bnei HaElohim, those of God, the bequeathed of God, those who are of the God or gods, because Elohim can be both a singular and a plural word, depending on how it's used. And so you have to start looking into who the Elohim were. And if they bequeathed the Nephilim, and there's something special about them, one thing you find in the Noah and the Ark story, by the way, this is a good place to insert this, we were always taught that God brought the flood on mankind and the animals two by two and build the ark and all of that because of the wickedness of mankind, and God was going to wipe out the whole earth and everybody on it because of their wickedness and their corruption, and he was going to save the one righteous man, Noah, and his family, and then all the animals, of course. You know the story. Even if you didn't go to church or synagogue, the story is fairly familiar. The only problem is that in the Hebrew language of that text, the implication is not one of sin or wickedness of man. It is the corruption of man that was brought to mankind by the preamble to the story, the Bnei HaElohim intermingling with the daughters of men and bequeathing a race, the Nephilim. And these corrupted mankind. Now, a corruption that was a little different. It wasn't that they just did evil things to them. It's that when you start studying into the text and you look at the context of the whole story from the Garden of Eden in the Old Testament up to the flood story in the Old Testament, that this whole issue was an issue of the corruption, a corrupted race, a corrupted bloodline brought to human bloodline. This is why there was a need for in the Jewish religion, a Messiah, which was first prophesied in the Garden of Eden, the coming Messiah, who was also known in the Hebrew vernacular as the Kinsman Redeemer. And all through the Old Testament, you have this the genealogies all laid out, and the stories all laid out, telling the coming of the Messiah, the one who would be one of us, the one who is of pure human blood, the one who is the Kinsman that would be the Redeemer, the Messiah, obviating the opposite. That there was a corrupt bloodline bequeathed that was not a bloodline that the Messiah could come from. If you keep stating over and over and over and over again that the Jews said the Messiah had to come from pure human blood, well, why do you have to say that if there's nothing else? Well, that's because there is an impure human bloodline as well, according to the Hebrew story. And this is the story of the Elohim mixing with the daughters of men and creating the race of the Nephilim. And so this is where that story begins in the Bible, and you will find that it spreads out all through the Old Testament. Almost the whole subtext of the whole Old Testament is the interaction of Elohim with humans. It happened in the Garden of Eden. With the serpent in the Garden of Eden, we all knew him as Lucifer or Satan, but that term is never used in the passage. That comes thousands of years later. It's attributed to Satan and Lucifer. The serpent is Nakosh, he's called. the bright shining one, the bringer of knowledge, the illuminator, the trickster, the kraken. These are all definitions of the word nakosh, which is the word for serpent in the Garden of Eden story. And what I believe you have happening in the Garden of Eden story is sexual encounter between Eve and nakosh. And when Eve brings it to Adam, she bears twins. The eldest twin, Cain, is the son of nakosh. The youngest, Abel, is the son of Adam. And this bears out by everything. It's not just me sucking this out of my thumb somewhere and thinking, oh, let's make a great story. It's you go right to the text and you find that everything supports this. The judgments that were brought on mankind and the serpent right after the whole Garden of Eden story. Everything leading up to the flood, where Noah, we're told, he was chosen because he was the only righteous man left and that he was pure in all his generations. Well, when you look at it in the Hebrew, it doesn't say righteous. It says he was the only pure-blooded man left in his family. He was pure in all his generations going back to Adam. And there was significance to that. So this is the foundation. And it's bloody just in trying to lay the building blocks of what the story is about. You can see how intricate it becomes and how much subtext there is to stories that we have always believed by faith, and especially if you're Judeo-Christian, but find that there are perhaps encoded messages beneath all of this, and it bears it out in everything that happens.
Fascinating points there. And, you know, Scotty, too, before I go to a wonderful question from our researcher, Lily from New York, I wanted to note here that your books describe the different and extensive references for the Nephilim and also the Gibberim. Gibberim, as you note, from the Hebrew word for the mightiest. The passages for these beings are noted Genesis and other scripture from the Torah, books of Jasher, the book of Enoch, Jubilees, and Dead Sea Scrolls book of the Giants, as well as the Mesopotamian archetypal figures and the Greek Titans and the ancient Irish traditions and, frankly, cultural accounts from across the globe. And before I ask Lily's excellent question, I just wanted to note here that a colleague of yours, Nick Redfern, recently interviewed was very much discussing the interest by the American and other world governments in Noah's Ark. So that's certainly a focus of very worthy and fascinating research. Now, my question here from Lily of New York is, Scotty, were the daughters of men the children of Adam and Eve? Were the daughters of men the children of Adam and Eve? If not, who were their parents?
The children of men, the term itself, the daughters of men, it says in the English. And I don't remember the Hebrew word for daughters, but it's the daughters of Adam, the daughters of Adam. And so this is, Adam is used as that archetype in the Old Testament of, because they use in the New Testament, they compare the Christ or Jesus Christ to the new Adam. There was the old Adam, which bequeathed mankind, and then the new Adam in the theology of the Redeemer in the New Testament sense. So Adam, whenever you see Adam connected to the bequeathing of a race, it's always mankind, it's always human, it's always pure human blood. Now, there's a big question as to whether or not there were other people here, that there were other created humans. I wrote about this, and you referenced very briefly the anthology book that I was part of, Lost Civilizations and Mysteries of the Past. And I wrote about Cain and the city of Cain, the city that he built when he left Eden. And it says that now, supposedly, according to that story, all we knew was there was Adam, Eve, and their two sons, Cain and Abel. Well, then Cain murders Abel, chicken scratch through Abel. It doesn't mention anybody else. It says, you know, the conversations that it shows between God and Cain, which, by the way, I also found very interesting, that God had all these conversations with Cain, the murderer, but never warned Abel, the one that was supposedly giving the righteous sacrifice to God and worshiped God the way he was supposed to. Well, Cain says, what will I do if you kick me out of here, which God said, I'm going to banish you. He says, where am I going to go? What people, when they find me, won't they kill me for what I've done? And God puts a mark on him. Then it says he goes east to the land of Nod, marries a woman, has a child, builds a city that he calls after his son Enoch, a different Enoch. And the story goes on from there. And the big questions are, who is he building the city for? Who were the people? Where did he get his wife? So on, so on, so on. And there's lots of theological answers both ways. But all of that, and I've probably drifted so far off your original question of rabbit trail that I don't think I even remember where I was going with that to answer the particular question. But if you repeat that question, I'll tie the math here.
Absolutely, though I thought you have really a lame foundation for answering the question. It is, again, from our Lily from New York. A question, Scotty, were the daughters of men the children of Adam and Eve? And if not, who were their parents?
Yes, I believe they were. If they weren't, then they were human. They were humans. They're saying, when they talk about the daughters of Adam, they're human. Now, this may not be of the line of Cain or the line of the third-born Seth. It may be other humans. But if it said they came from Adam, you can pretty much bet that, at least according to Hebrew mythology, religious mythology, this is who they were. They were the children of Adam.
Thank you. Great answer. Now, and thank you, Lily. Now, Scotty, do you feel that there's a definite linkage between past ancient historical events and the Nephilim, and that even in the contemporary era, the Nephilim cause major disruption behind the scenes in just the current human political scenario? And do you think world acknowledgement of the Nephilim might cause major disruption to belief systems?
Well, that's a big loaded question because what that ties into is some of the stuff that I wrote about in my new book on the reptilians. And there's this, you know, in some alienist fields, there are these theories that the reptilians are a race that has been here since the beginning of time, that they came from, the way you would find it on the internet, you look almost everywhere and look for reptilians, you'll see, they're a race from the constellation of Draco, and they came here and they subjugated mankind, and now they operate and are trying to overthrow all of humanity again. They work behind even the pseudo-mythological Illuminati. They're the things, the beings that run the things that take place in this world. Now, in biblical speak, it always said that Satan or Lucifer was the god of this world, or the small g god of this world, the prince of the power of the earth, the one that is manipulating all of mankind. But you find this in all different kinds of religious mythology, these same stories. And so when you start comparing them, you find they all talk about the same thing. And it's, as I like you to, you got to throw everything else out and say it's exactly what the Bible teaches you, and it's Satan, and it's all of this. Or it's broader than that, that there's something more to it, and perhaps the Hebrew Bible is simply a version of these events. And do they live and breathe and work on this planet? I think that, yes, there is still interactivity of that kind. Perhaps a little different now. Everybody's got their theories about why it could be different nowadays. But I think that you see a lot of interaction still going on. I'll just make that empirical statement without backing it up right now. That would take another hour. But you also have your current mythology, which I believe is built off of ancient mythology. I believe that something that I stumbled on, and it's not new news to people, but it was new to me, and it really knocked me off my kilter or faith-wise when I started coming across this stuff, was how many things we find in biblical scripture, in the Old Testament and the Old Testament stories, that coincide with religious mythologies that were thousands of years older. So I believe all of these things have started to tie together. I believe you still have this stuff going on. I don't think you can define it simply by spirituality or religious definitions. I think there's something more underneath it all, something more there. You have the Book of Enoch, again, that apocryphal book that speaks of the demonic or the evil spirits that plague mankind, like nowadays if you talk about demonology or things like that or exorcism, that these are all sourced in the ghosts, he says, of the Nephilim, that the dead Nephilim who all perished since they were born on the earth, they are bound to the earth. Since they brought evil and corruption to mankind, they will continue to bring evil and corruption to mankind in spirit form down through the ages. That is a spiritual, or a Jewish, if you will, a Hebrew version of these events, of what these spirit beings are. So on a spiritual sense, you've got one guy telling you, yeah, they're still here in spirit form. In an alienist sense, or a ufological sense, if you will, you've got people supporting the theory that it's a race from old that's been here all the time and is still here. You've got guys like, I think Zechariah Sitchin was one that made a huge tie-in for the reptilians being part of the cast of the Anunnaki. Simply because you had some reptilian beings represented in some of the iconography of the Anunnaki. And all the Anunnaki were the Sumerian cast of gods, just like the Greeks had their Olympians, their cast of pantheon of gods. The Anunnaki, the Amu, the Amuna, they were all these gods that were the pantheon that supposedly created, according to the Sumerian story, created primeval man, they call it, to do their work for them. They enslaved primeval man. That was their reason for creating man, was to do work for them. To till their land, to dig their mines, or mine natural resources, and so on. And it was Elul, the chief god of the Sumerians, Anunnaki, who ordered this to be done. And then Enki, his brother god, also known as Ea in the neighboring Akkadian culture, it was Enki who saw the plight of the humans being enslaved and came down and taught them how to rebel against the other gods of the Anunnaki. And he led the rebellion and taught them the forbidden knowledges of the gods and, in a sense, raised them up. And he did this all from a place known as, where Enki dwelt, the Serpent's Marsh. It was also known as Iaden or Iaden. And then we start making the comparisons 3,000 years later to the Old Testament book of Genesis. And you've got the story of the Garden of Eden where God, known as El in the Canaanite culture, same as Elul, the migration of religion over 3,000 years from the Fertile Crescent to the Canaanite region, they picked up the term El, and El became Elohim, El Shaddai, El Elyon, El, the God of the Hebrews. Well, God created man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to till the ground and keep it for him, it says. Just a little softer version of creating mankind to till the fields for us and do our work for us. Enki, Ea, with that same migration of language and religion, ended up in the Canaanite culture being known as Ea, became Ea, which is the base word for Jehovah, and the same word as Jehovah. And so this was the God that brought the forbidden knowledges to humans and freed them, and he's equated by the Serpent's Marsh, Ea's den to Eden and the serpent in the garden. So all of these things, and what did the serpent in the garden really do? He delivered forbidden knowledge to the humans, and the humans acted on it. And that's very interesting that even when, and you miss this, it's so easy to miss. In the Garden of Eden story, it says that the serpent offered the fruit, and it says, and Eve looked at the fruit and saw that it was pleasing to the eye and would bring her wisdom and knowledge. Now, how can you look at a piece of fruit and go, hey, I've never had that before, but that looks good, and it's going to make me wise. I've never done that, eating a banana or an apple. I go, wow, I'm hungry, and I bet you that'll give me something to eat. So right there's a clue as to this hidden subtext. That's just a clue. Why are they saying that Eve saw that it would make her wise? There's something more to the subtext of the story. And then when she takes that forbidden fruit, this is the, I believe, the sexual activity that took place. And so you've got this huge story in the Bible, in Genesis. That's the beginning of mankind and the fall of mankind and the serpent character. Then you go back 3,000 years earlier and see the same story told in a different way. So That is the big story, I think. And again, I've drifted off of whatever question you asked. Like I said, you put a nickel in me and I'll talk for an hour. So.
No, Scotty, fascinating comments and a segue into my further questions. Also here, just a brief aside there in the Garden of Eden situation. I know that our International Director of ICAR, the International Community for Alien Research, Joe Montaldo, has on several occasions mentioned that he believes that a reptilian might have been involved in that scenario, the presentation, or the reptilians, the presentation of knowledge to humans. Also, am I correct, going back to the Sumerians and the Akkadians, that those who actually were alleged to have interacted with these beings or had direct knowledge of them did not first consider the Anunnaki as gods?
As a matter of fact, they called in their own cuneiform tablets, their own writings, they called the Anunnaki as their gods. That is their pantheon of gods whom they worship. Now, anthropologists and archaeologists will tell you, well, some of these things, we might be able to attribute these to older kings of the Anunnaki. It was a kingly caste, not a pantheon of gods. But this is in their old writings. They're referred to as their gods. And as far as that serpent character in the garden, it's very interesting that when you look at the definition of his name, it roughly is defined by the same definition as the term Elohim. It says that the Elohim, there's a couple of places you find them in the Old Testament. Whether they were serpentine or not is not mentioned in the Bible about the Elohim, but it certainly mentions about the serpent in the garden. But here's an interesting comparison. When God is speaking to the Elohim in Psalm 82, he addresses them by his same name. And the more I said Elohim could be both plural and singular, depending on the context of the words around it in the Hebrew. Well, it's like I would deer. I'd see a deer in my front yard, seeing a herd of deer, plural, in my backyard. It's a word that's used like that. And him in the Hebrew, just like Nephilim and Elohim, that im suffix in the Hebrew language is a suffix that denotes plurality just all by itself. The him is tacked on. Nephal is the word. Nephalim is the plurality of the word. And like Elohim, El is the word for God, Him is the plurality. So the name used for God almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament, Elohim literally means God among many gods, or God of many gods, or God that is part of many gods. And so now the Elohim he's speaking to in Psalm 82, it says this, it says, and Elohim stood, singular act, in the midst of the Elohim, plurality, and he, singular, said to them, plural, you are all Elohim, plural, the bright, shining princes of heaven. Now, there's an interesting clue right there. Go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, the serpent character. The definition of his name, Nakosh, meant crafty magician, bringer of knowledge and illumination, the illuminator, the bright, shining one. This is the character that encountered Eve in the Garden of Eden, according to the Hebrew story. And if this was indeed one of the Elohim, that would make them Cain, Eve's firstborn twin son, one of the Nephilim, the first of the Nephilim. And then you also have the sons of God, the Bene HaElohim, who came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. Same act that happened in the Garden of Eden. This Elohim, means Elohim, this is what I've said, and I may have said it to you before. I step out on a branch, not wanting to offend anybody's religious or spiritual sensibilities, especially if you're a Judeo-Christian, but the Bible does not teach monotheism. It teaches polytheism. It teaches that there is a caste of gods, and that Jehovah God, as we know him, or the God of the Old Testament, is the chief of them, just like Zeus was the chief of the Olympians. He could be overthrown, according to those legends and myths, but what happens to the Bible when he encounters the other gods of the Bible? He has power over them in Psalm 82. He renders judgment on them in that whole passage, but he equates them to himself by the usage of the same word. They are the, he is Elohim and they are Elohim. And so that's a very interesting point. And then when you start bringing it back to the God or the serpent in the garden who impregnated Eve, he is one of the Elohim, one of the bright shining ones. And I may have mentioned this to you before when we talked before, but I thought that brings up one of the coolest other cultural, I'm using the way to say it, some other culture that speaks of these kind of beings, and you find them in every culture. In over 600 different cultures, they speak of beings like these Elohim. But you've got the story of the Tuatha De Danann, who came down to the ancient Irish, and the Tuatha De Danann were the ones that were the bright, shining kings from heaven that came down, and they intermingled with humans, and they taught the privileges of the gods, and there were wars, and they were driven into the hollow hills in the Celtic mythology and became known as the Elven Folk. And the Elven Folk, that being another derivation of the word El, you've got Elven, and it's the way the word breaks down. And so it's very interesting that in the Irish stories, Tuatha De Danann were their version of the Elohim and the Nephilim, their offspring. And there's even some new work on translating Tuatha De Danann. It's not as new as you might think. It's a newer look at it, but it's an older idea. But the goddess, the Tuatha De Danann were called that because they were the children of the goddess Danu. But there is also some translation of that renders it the children of the gods of the Anu, or the Anunnaki. So there are linkages to all these characters all through history, and that's just one of them.
Boy, those are interesting derivations. And also, Scotty, could you give us some details on one type of being described in your first book, accounts of it, Nagas, or serpent people of Buddhist and Hindu traditions?
Yes, now, I'm not as up on the Hindu tradition as I should be. There are many things like ancient Hebrew linguistics. I'm not an ancient Hebrew linguist. I don't do that for a living. I didn't study that. I go to the people who know about it, and I study them, and I reference them. Same with the Naga of the Hindu. I make reference to them. I make a heavier reference to them in the book about the reptilians. In that they are similar types of characters. I have not gone into, Vishnu. I have not dug into all the Indian writings of this. It's so broad. Those things, as far as I'm concerned, are books unto themselves and studies unto themselves. So I just make reference to them and write reference. I don't dig into it very deeply. I pretty much stuck to the Hebrew tradition in order to bring that out, referencing many different points throughout history. So I can't speak overtly intelligently to the Naga.
No, but that information is very intriguing as well. And just as a brief aside, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Scotty, your book's reference, your first book, and I can't wait to read the second, your first book, The Rise of Nephilim, refers to the Divine Council, and then also the Sumerian reference, the Assembly of the Gods. Your argument is that the actual the first source, or God, would be the greater one among a council of fellow beings of superior powers or traits or knowledge.
Yes, almost like Elul was to the Anunnaki, like Zeus was to the Olympians. You've got Elohim is to the rest of the Elohim.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some theories, by the way, that state that Elohim, that Genesis chapter 1, we used to call it when I was in seminary, we weren't taught this. We had news about this. And we had one seminary professor who they used to call Batty Bernie behind his back, of Bernard Northrop. I'm not even sure if he's still living. He was pushing elderly back then when I was in the late 70s, early 80s. But he had theories of Atlantis, and he had theories of something he called the gap theory between Genesis 1-1 and Genesis 1-2. And he said the Hebrew is implicit in its language. And he said, it's not just a recap you're seeing of creation after verse 1 in Genesis 1. It's a whole new creation. There was a gap in there. And he built on that theory. And I think one of the theories about Elohim is that there was Elohim created the heavens and the earth. Then Yahweh Elohim created the second earth. and created man and so on. That everything had been created, and then Yahweh Elohim came in and recreated it. And this was one of the theories that, and how do you prove any of this? You don't. It's speculative, but you go on the information you can find. And at least biblically speaking, in the Hebrew religion, it looks like almost two creations coinciding. Elohim and Yahweh Elohim. And Yahweh Elohim created Adam and Eve, and according to that legend. So, I only use that. I haven't thrown out the baby with the bathwater, but I've stepped away a bit, and I have to look at this stuff from outside the box, if you will, to say the Jewish or the Hebrew story in the Old Testament isn't the only story that tells these stories. It's in hundreds of ancient cultures. And different castes or different courses of events, but basically the same common threads. And what do you do with that? When you step back, you go, wait a minute. Is the Hebrew Bible the truth? Or is the Hebrew Bible the Hebrew version of these events? And that's where it starts to look like you could secularize these things a bit, if you will. You start getting into ancient alien theory or paleo contact, and what do you have? You have ancient mankind who encountered beings from possibly another world that they deemed as gods, angels, devils, and demons, and everything in between, when they were possibly nothing of the sort. But that doesn't expurgate demonology or spirituality or spirit beings from anything. And they just don't think they're all the same thing anymore.
Boy, very intriguing comments there. And, you know, Scotty, as far as the reptilians, and earlier, if I remember it correctly, you mentioned that there is a relation there to the Nephilim, but not that they are directly equivalent to them. But now, Scotty, a fellow researcher and friend of mine, frequently has told me of his very strong opinion that the reptilians represent a race which existed on Earth from a far earlier period than humans. What would be your response to this opinion?
My response to that is that that's a great theory, just like everything else. It's a theory because there is no possible way to prove it. Mm-hmm. All we can do is find things that look like it's evidence of this. You find the reptilian figurines, you find the reptilians in all kinds of sculpture and iconography from Mesoamerica to the Philippines to Asia to Asia Minor to the Fertile Crescent to Africa. They're everywhere, North America. You can't deny the presence of the serpent or the reptilian figure down through history. That is one of those things that looks like there's a common sort of scientific methodology to it, which is why we cannot link all these things. It looks like they all have similar source points. And it starts to build a sort of methodology that makes sense as a working theory. And all we can do is speculate on those things. There's no way we can prove it. Now, the people who say they can prove it, maybe we have had experiences or known experiencers, if you will. But isn't that the same thing that, let's just pull this figure out of biblical history, Moses. Moses had an experience with the burning bush. Nobody else was there. Who wrote about it? Moses. Moses said, and I read about this in the Nephilim book, where I'm establishing that Moses is indeed the author of the first five books of the Bible and of these stories. And there's a place where Moses, I believe he brought all kinds of things from Egypt with him, all kinds of things from ancient Sumerian culture, things he had learned, and he created Judaism out of whole cloth. He created that religion, but then remember, he is also, and people go, look at all the things that happened to the Hebrews when they left Egypt, all the signs and the wonders and the partings of the seas and all these things. I could gather, who wrote that? Moses wrote that, the man who established Judaism. And you've got Moses writing in one place, I believe it's in the book of Numbers, when they were wandering in the wilderness, it said he would pitch his tent outside the camp, and that God would descend on his tent in the form of a cloud, and Moses talked to God face to face as a man talks to his friend, he writes. But then 9 verses later, in the same chapter, Moses also writes, and no man can see God's face and live. What was he saying in that contradiction? Because in a few verses earlier, he said, I talk to God face to face, like a man talks to his friend, but no man can see God in his face and live. He was equating himself to God. He was elevating himself higher than the normal man. He's saying, I'm more than a man. I am, what did he bring with him from Egypt? Being groomed for the fellowship in 18th dynasty Egypt, I'm a brother God to the gods because I am the chosen leader. And this is what he taught those people. So I think experiencers like that, he founded a whole religion based on his singular experience that nobody else saw. And then he wrote those things down. I often wondered, too, if I was one of those Hebrews led out of bondage in Egypt after these 10 miraculous plagues, then brought to the Red Sea, and this pillar of fog comes down and separates Pharaoh's army from us, and Moses spreads his rod over the waters parts during the night, and we walk across on dry land. Then they close again on Pharaoh's army and drown them. And we see all these wondrous acts. Why 40 days later were we building a golden calf as our God? Oh, let's build this calf and make this our God. Why were they doing that? I think we're missing bits of the story. Because I think perhaps Moses, in writing what he wrote, was writing something to establish a religion. And I'm not throwing it out and saying it didn't happen, that the miraculous didn't happen, but when you have these things happen from one experiencer, I've said all that to build up to this, is that I think some of this reptilian stuff, some of the alien stuff that we deal with, there's not that there's no truth behind any of it, or facts behind any of it, but generally you will find movements that believe this based on one guy's experience. And then everybody else goes, I think we have ancient myth building, ancient religion building happening today, the same way we saw it thousands of years ago.
Very interesting argument. You know, as well, when you write about Moses in your first book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, I really was fascinated by the comments that you believe that Moses was found by a young female Egyptian royal who later became the Egyptian pharaoh Hatshepsut. Also, you believe the eventual adversary to Moses, as the advocate for the Hebrews, was the pharaoh Thutmose III or Thutmosis III. Also, that Moses, before he adopted the Hebrew name, became was a high official of Egypt named Senmut or Senenmut. I hope I'm correctly pronouncing that.
Yes, Senmut.
With many Senmut. Thank you. With one particular title of many, two, chief architect and hereditary prince and count. That was very interesting research. But now my question to you is, do you see a Nephilim mix in here, in the events, rather, of the Exodus?
You know, I didn't look for a Nephilim mix because I didn't see one. Nothing jumped out at me, so I didn't bring that even out in there. The Nephilim mix. There's a possibility of that, but I don't see anything other than really external writings and opinion writings and speculative writings about Moses that might link him to that. I don't see that at all. I see him as a guy. He's a guy in extraordinary circumstances with an extraordinary upbringing, an extraordinary education, an extraordinary claim to royalty, and somebody that, according to the story we were taught, He murdered an Egyptian taskmaster who was beating a Hebrew slave, and he flees and leaves all of this behind for being a man who is part of the royal family, yet murdering somebody who is one step above a slave. And he runs for the rest of his life from this. I think we're missing part of his story. I think more took place. I think his brother in name only, Thutmose the third, who was the rival for the throne, and probably the truer by blood from his father, the heir to the throne of Egypt. But I think Hatshepsut, his stepmother, was raising Moses, her stepson, to replace him, because she didn't want to. There's a great hatred of the family blood. And this is what I think happened, is that there was political rivalry. There was something going on there, and his opponent found buzz to wipe out his political opponent for the throne. And so Moses flees. What happens even 40 years later when he has the experience of the burning bush, and he says, God tells him to go back. What's his answer? I can't go back. They're seeking my life there. Well, 40 years later, the Pharaoh is going to take the life of somebody of the royal family for murdering a slave? I don't think that was the actual event. I think it was more than lay the surface than what we're getting. And you got to remember, Moses wrote the book. So.
That's very intriguing.
No, I don't think he was Nephilim. I'm sorry. I don't think he was Nephilim. I think he was just a guy.
Okay. Now, Scotty, you also mentioned the Atum, A-T-U-M, the Egyptian snake man. I was trying to do some research on it, on that particular reference, the Atum, and I note a potential reference to the Egyptian pyramid text. Do you think the Atum might possibly be some type of report or a record of a past Nephilim connection there?
Well, it's possible. I know Atum is also referred to as a reptilian of sorts, a serpent god. And he's the one who was like the completer or the finisher of things. He was the complete one, is what he was called. And he was the one that turned, in essence, turned the watery world into some kind of new creative cycle. And this is who he was. And I reference him just briefly again in the Reptilians book as one of the Egyptian representations of, again, a serpent-type character involved in creation, involved in holding things together, involved in the completeness of man and the completeness of humans. And he was actually one of the earliest known deities of the ancient Egyptians, is the Atum. And then there's a lot to know about him. Again, he's somebody that you could write another whole book on. So there's connectivity, again, just like everything else has connectivity, that has this whole serpent aspect to it.
Very thought-provoking. And I think we're way to go into break, but as a final question, the 10-minute break. Scotty, you indicate in your first book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, the potential strong similarity between accounts of reported abductions and the ancient texts, such as the Sumerian and biblical texts, a sort of a connection between the contemporary world and the past records.
Yes, this is where, when you look at the sons of God intermingling with the daughters of men and having children by them, this is more poetic, more religious language, mythological, religious mythology, if you will. I know that in the New Testament, and this is the first time I kind of stumbled on this, and it was maybe 15 years ago. Again, not new to everybody. It was new to me back then. I remember finding that verse where Jesus himself, and I think it's in the Gospel of Mark, I think, off the top of my head, where he says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be again at the time of the coming of the Son of Man, which was a reference to end times types of speaking. Back then, we always taught that just simply meant the world will be wicked, we were taught, just like it was at the time of Noah. But what is it you find that happened at the time of Noah? At the time of Noah, the Nephilim were widespread on the earth. The sons of God, the Elohim, were intermingling with the daughters of men. They were abducting them, if you will. And I said, what if this has anything to do? And this is before I even started looking and researching into it or reading what other people said about it. But my raw thoughts were, what if that just simply means the kind of abduction stories we've been hearing even over the last two generations? And you can see it all down through the ages with the incubus and the succubus and all kinds of contact from otherworldly spirit beings intermingling with humans, mostly male figures with human figures. And then you get to the succubus, which is the female form of the incubus, which kind of, not to be too crass, but I know one of the theories in the Malefactorum, I think it was called, the book written in the 1400s for the Inquisition on witches, one of the theories that they operated, well, they didn't even call it a theory, they just said, well, obviously, the succubus is an incubus in female form who will then take the sperm of the man who has had sex with her and carried off to somewhere else and impregnated something else. And, you know, these are the things that we're saying in the Malus Malefactorum. if I'm pronouncing that right. My Latin is so bad. So that is all down through the ages. I think abduction from beings other than humans has been taking place in one form or another. And so I believe what you've got is the same story being told over again in ufological or alien abduction theory.
Very interesting response. Now, to Scotty and our listeners, we must now take a 10-minute break for network promotions. In the interim, I would direct our listeners to review these excellent websites, scottallenroberts.com, intrepidmag.com, and paradigmsymposium.com. We'll be right back, and I'm just going to stay on the line. We resume in about 10 minutes, and Scotty, wonderful discussion, and even though you have a bad cold, we really don't know, just hearing great commentary. Back in 10.
Oh, that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
everyone. Trish Sheridan, Humble Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at a Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Hi, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and I have a new show that will air the first Friday of every month from 11 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. The show is called Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It's all about psychic readings. I welcome my listeners to call in for a free reading. Just remember, don't ask me a question that you really don't want the answer to. I'll give it to you the way the spirits give it to me. Straightforward and real. The first Friday of every month. Insight, 11 to midnight.
Hello, I'm Chip.
And I'm Nicole.
Together we host the Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
We broadcast live every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern for 2 full hours. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, as well as our website, mindcemetery.com.
We cover all the topics you won't hear on your local news.
Well, I don't really like watching the news anyway.
Then this is the show for someone like you.
I wouldn't go that far. After all, I am the skeptic.
So you don't believe in ghosts?
Nope.
UFOs?
Yeah, no.
How about Bigfoot?
Not really. You'll never find a Bigfoot.
How about the lost city of Atlantis, then?
Isn't that on Google Earth? No? Then forget it. It's never going to get found.
Looks like I have my work cut out for me, then, as I take on a true skeptic as we discuss the latest and hottest topics in the UFO and paranormal fields with some of the most provocative and informative guests to hit the airwaves.
That's right, you do. And it all happens right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, live every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, as well as mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Julie Scott, the host of The Downer Shades. I'd like to invite you to tune in to The Downer Shades each Tuesday from 8 to 9 Central. Each week, we explore a different facet of the paranormal world, from fortune telling to your cult and everything in between. We find the guests fascinating and informative as we embark on a different journey each Tuesday evening. Once again, The Downer Shades from 8 to 9 Central on Tuesday.
Hi everyone, this is Second Sight NYC. You can join us each Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
We're a parapsychic radio show that isn't afraid to push the limits.
We have limits?
Well, if we do, we haven't found them yet.
Chris is the godfather of psychic mediums, and he'll give you a reading you can't refuse.
You better believe it. And Stephanie is the co-hostess with the mostest.
Relax there, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Second Sight NYC is the show that even the spirits listen to.
How can you make such a claim?
Well, the spirits told me. Give us 2 hours to open your minds to the possibilities of what could be.
This show is all about what is seen and unseen, known and unknown, and everything in between.
Each week, we make the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the sky, wondering if there's something out there?
In fear of things going bump in the night.
This Freak Radio brings you head first into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With Ruby Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed with the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God, they're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that... Listen to the Judge of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchard, bringing you the high strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com. www.theleasenews.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
My name is James O'Connell, and I'm the founder of the Experiencers Alien Encounter Research Team. And yes, my extraterrestrial visitors told me to seek out others like myself and then look within. So we know they've left clues for us to unlock. Each experiencer may have a piece of this cosmic puzzle hidden in their subconscious memories, and this information is leading us on a scavenger hunt for the answers to this extraterrestrial phenomenon. Come along with us as we examine the lives of ordinary people that are involved in extraordinary circumstances. Expect to experience the mystical, magical, and miraculous. Because where our team goes, alien encounters follow. This amazing journey begins with us because we, the Experiencers Alien Encounter Research Team from the John Mack Institute.
I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Scotty Roberts. We'll be discussing Scott Allen Roberts' books, which, among others, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim and The Secret History of the Reptilians, as well as the Paradigm Symposium, this October 18th through the 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where Scotty will be a speaker and co-host. Websites referenced during this interview include scottallenroberts.com, intrepidmag.com, and paradigmsymposium.com. Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Scotty Roberts. Scotty's several books, articles, and research are referenced at these sites, scottallenroberts.com, intrepidmag.com, and paradigmsymposium.com. And sometime during the second hour, we will be hearing a great promo for the upcoming Paradigm Symposium this October 18th through 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. At this point in the show, I'd like to mention to our listeners to not miss these excellent programs on our network. Directly after this show at 11 p.m. Eastern, The Galactic Connection airs live with host Erica Getch and guest Dr. Rita Louise. Other programs of the UPRN network include UFO Undercover, Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern with host Joe Montaldo. Second Sight NYC on Thursdays from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern with co-hosts Stephanie Benetti and psychic medium Chris George. On Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, Through the Keyhole with host Karen Dolan. On the first Friday of the month, p.m. Eastern, Insight with psychic medium Chris George. And on Saturdays, News on the Flip Side with hosts Stephanie Benetti and Joe Montaldo at 9 p.m. Eastern, also directly followed on Saturday nights by Church of Mavis, or COM, with Jeffrey Pritchett. And don't forget, on Mondays, husband and wife team Chip and Nicole host Mind Cemetery. Now, I'd love to get back to these questions on your great books, Scotty, and of course, I will not forget to, I can't wait to discuss that Paradigm Symposium that will be held now in about 2.5 weeks, so I'm very excited about this.
It's going to be exciting.
It certainly will, October 18th to the 21st in Minneapolis. And just to complete some of my questions on your upcoming The Secret History of the Reptilians, available February 2013. Now, Scotty, several reports coming in, let me rephrase this. Some of our key ICAR researchers often use the term amphibians to also describe the reptilians. Have you heard that amphibian term referenced at all in your work or in your research?
I have. I've heard it in modern usage. I've seen it in the ancient usage. When you go back to the Sumerian culture again, you have the god Aranes, who, according to Berosus, who is a 4th century Babylonian philosopher and magician and writer and all of this, theologian, if you will, wrote about Aranes, the half-man, half-fish, or amphibious type of god that rose up out of the Persian Gulf with his people during the day, and they would teach the knowledge of the gods and teach civilization and all this to the ancient Sumerian culture. And then go back at night. And this is one of those amphibious type of, because he wasn't strictly reptilian. He was noted as being half man, half fish. Now, of course, an archaeologist, secular archaeologist would tell you, or an anthropologist would just say, well, all the inscriptions you see of these ancient kings or priests wearing the giant carp garb from the fish head over their head, there's a big cape going all the way down. This was just costumes we saw represented on steles or on carvings and reliefs and statuary. and of course, others say, no, it's actual representations of these beings. So, yeah, I've heard of them, and I cite them. I cite some passages about Aranes in the Nephilim book.
Well, that's very intriguing. Now, Scotty, I also find very interesting that ICAR is receiving some experiencer accounts that reptilians can more easily comprehend human feelings, religious beliefs, and family attachments than, for example, the Greys. Have you heard anything of this?
You know, I don't know enough about that. I haven't studied the Greys to a great extent. I have heard that they are, you know, emotionless or have less emotion that they depict. But I don't know enough about that particular topic to speak to it intelligently.
Mm-hmm. And, Scotty, now this would just be my impressions. I have heard mixed reports of violent versus nonviolent behavior and attitudes regarding reptilians. Now, for example, you note several accounts from past ancient historical area. Past ancient historical eras, pardon me, I'm lisping tonight, that the reptilians are noted as being responsible to assist in the formation of culture and other aspects. Pardon me, that's really a very rambling question.
Sure. The way that I've seen that they are associated with the founding of civilization is that they are so strongly associated with some of the ancient gods, the ancient Anunnaki. It was once thought that the Sumerian culture was the oldest civilization on the planet.
Yes.
And, of course, so we would go to those stories and we'd see the reptilian depictions of the Anunnaki in some cases, and we would make that linkage to reptilian figures. I had mentioned very briefly Zechariah Sitchin in all of his work, strongly talks about the reptilian connection. The only problem I have with that, especially with Sitchin, is I would say this. Sitchin was on to something. I don't think you can theorize about all this stuff and not have something to go on. The prosecution is that he was such a horrid linguist, and he so butchered ancient Sumerian language that he misinterpreted language. One of the here's one for instance. He talks about the Anunnaki being the children of the fiery rockets. And the problem is he uses the Sumerian word mu, M-U, as his word that he interprets fiery rockets because he associated it with a domed craft and fire and coming from the sky and so on. The only problem is that he says that since there is no lexicon of ancient Sumerian language, this is what we can make of it as we break it down. The problem is there is an ancient lexicon. The ancient writers of these cuneiform tablets use all these different forms of language back then, and they created their own lexicon. So there is a definition to the word mu that has nothing to do with fiery rockets, and has nothing to do with fire, has nothing to do with anything domed. It speaks of, mu just simply speaks of the heavens or coming from the heavens. So like rain coming from the heavens even could be an application of that word. So Sitchin, I believe Zaire, which is one of the problems people fall into when you get into theorizing about these things, we so want it to be what we want it to be that we're willing to either deliberately overlook or turn a blind eye to something as we're interpreting it. And we come up with our interpretations of things. Sitchin, does this then render his whole theory meaningless and useless? Well, to a point, yeah, it does. If I'm going to misinterpret ancient language and make that huge square peg fit into that tiny little small hole in order to make my theory work, I've either dismissed what is really there, I've overlooked it, or I've deliberately... I can't say as deliberately as hoodwinked something like that, but I have created something that fits my argument as opposed to going with what's really there. So when you talk about the reptilian connection to all these beings, there is connectivity there, but there is no proof. There's no proof they came from other planets, no proof of any of that. What we can do, though, is just like I did with the Adam and Eve story and Cain and all the things that happened around them, is extrapolate from other religious myths that are out there in different mythologies that talk about how do I know Cain and Abel were twins? I don't. The scripture in the Hebrew Bible in the Old Testament doesn't say they're twins. But every other creation family, well, a vast majority of them in other cultures, speak of the first family of the woman having born twins or triplets or quadruplets or quintuplets even. And it's a common theme out there. And so when you look at that story and you look at the way it's told, it's wide open for extrapolating that information in and saying, it looks like Cain and Abel could have been the Hebrew version of the first family's set of twins. And this is what I think you get. And that's honest, I think, scholarship when it's put in that speculative category. However, with Sitchin's work, he doesn't label it as speculative. This is what it says. And he's made too many mistakes to look at his work and say, yeah, he's Mark. So when you get these reptilian theories going, there are other source points to draw them from all through history. You can build a pretty good case for there being a race of reptilians. Where they're from, the constellation of Draco or somewhere in Orion's belt, nobody ever says that. You can extrapolate that information, though, from different constellations mentioned. Even the Bible itself speaks of the constellation of Draco. The oldest chronological book of the Bible, the book of Job, pre-Judaism, talks about the trials of Job, and he mentions that and God says to Job, I was here before the Pleiades were in the sky and before Orion was there. And there's one other, I think it was Draco was mentioned, there's one other constellation mentioned. But these same three constellations mentioned there in a Jewish book establishing Jewish religion was also mentioned in ancient Sumerian culture. The same three constellations were held in high regard and worshipped even. the pyramids in the Giza Plateau, even built in layouts, and other different ancient spiritual sites built in layouts of some of these installations. So when you start looking at all that information, you can't prove anything by it. You can extrapolate speculative theory out of it, and that's about all you can do. Same with the reptilians. Probably exist. Maybe some experiencers who could say, I know they exist, but can you prove they exist? No. You can prove that there's evidence that looks like they had effect all through history, but what is that? Is that an alien race that has affected us, or is the simple anthropology? Ideas picked up from one culture to the next, to the next, to the next, and carried all throughout the world in the ancient history. So you've got to look at it from that pure standpoint of saying, I have to do with biblical topics. I have to separate myself from theology and religion of the Bible in order to decipher and decode some of the messages of the stories they tell. You've got to do the same thing with ancient alien theory. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist that way. It means you've got to step away from what you want it to be and find out what it's really saying. And that's what my study in these books are all about, is to find out, are these reptilians real characters? Or are they characters that are carried from culture, religion to religion, all down through the ages? And what does that mean when you find it? Those are the things you have to do. And becoming a thinker that is one that says, I'm not a big S skeptic, which says, no, it isn't. No, it doesn't. Big S skeptics to me are denialists, like Michael Shermer and Dr. Richard Dawkins. These are denialists. They are big S skeptics. It's just a no, it isn't answered. Oh, religion is trash, or this doesn't work. The small S skeptics is what we should all be. You might believe that something is so, but you have to approach it with a skeptical open mind to say, I am willing to learn that the thing that I think is might not be so. And I look at the late astrophysicist Richard Feynman, listening to a lecture of his, and he said, you know, there's a lot of things I know a lot about. He's a contemporary, by the way, of Einstein and Oppenheimer. And he said, there's a lot of things, he says, I don't know much about. And he said, there's a whole lot of things I don't know anything about. And he said, I would rather die not knowing the answers for certain to some things than to live my whole life believing something was so and then finding out it wasn't. And I think that is what we are in the danger of. Even when we think we're being scientific about some of these topics, we want to know the answers to these things, these alien questions. But there's not enough information to say, I know this for certain. And many times we will opt for the ancient alien question or even the scientific question over a religious answer to something because we don't want to accept a certain thing. And so we want to make sure that we fall out so we accept this or this in its place. But many times what we're doing is establishing a new religion for ourselves. I think ancient alienism, if you're not careful, it becomes just as much a doctrinal, theological religion as anything else because we put our strictures on it. And we say, this is the way it is, and this is what I think, and this is what I feel it is. Therefore it is, based on sketchy evidence. But many times the evidence we have to establish hypotheses are just as sketchy as the evidence to establish that God exists as Jehovah. We have information, but we don't have fact, and we don't have proof. So we have to, and all of that being said, I'm not saying it isn't so. I'm saying we can't say it so without a shadow of a doubt because we just don't know. So we work on trying to find the answers.
Very strong arguments there, and you know, Scotty, regarding the Sitkin point and his translations, I know Professor Mike Heiser definitely has taken him to task on some of the material. Now, Scotty, I probably just have two more questions here, and then I want to get to that great conference. Number one, On the secret history of the reptilians, are there several past archaeological or ancient historical accounts where a certain ruler might have claimed to have reptilian ancestry?
But one that sticks out, and this isn't as ancient as you might think, although it's ancient, you go back to kind of the Dark Ages, the Merovingians. I wanted to try to find that connectivity between ancient mythology of the reptilians and modern mythology. And, of course, it led me into the Nazis. It led me into the Thule Society. Let me start there for a moment. Adolf Hitler joined a group called the Thule Society in 1919 when he was roughly 30, 31 years old, something like that. Now, the Thule Society was supposed to be this big nationalistic Germanic society on its surface, and this is what the Nazi Party was formed out of. But deep down inside of it, it was founded by occultists, I mean, very strict old Germanic occultists. And European occultists, the Madame Blavinsky type of occultists. And they founded the Thule Society, and they believed they were the alien race. They were the ancestors, their ancestors were the Atlanteans, and that they had special communication with the spirits of Atlantis. This is the stuff Hitler was involved with. And this is why, you know, when you see, like, even in a movie like Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones, you will hear the government officials talking about, yeah, Hitler, he's about the occultic stuff. Well, it was true. This is what he was all about. And this is where he got the founding of his ideals that turned into his politics. This was his religion, if you will. Now, the interesting thing is that the Thule Society was based on the Merovingian theories, going further back even than the Atlanteans. The Merovingians were founded by one ruler, Merovic. And Merovic, who lived in, I believe, the late 600s, the early 700s, but earlier than that, 400s to the 500s. And he claimed that he was fully human, but that he was also, his mother was also dually impregnated by a giant serpent from the sea, a serpent god. And that his bloodline was the bloodline of not only of Christ, through the which was their teachings, he was part of the whole Priory of Sion type of stuff that we've read about and fictionalized in the Dan Brown books and so on. He believed he was part of that bloodline of Christ, but also a dual bloodline flowing through his bloodstream, that of the serpent, that of the great dragon, that of Lurian bloodlines. And he brought this into the rulers, the Merovingian rulers, who ruled the Franco culture, the French culture, in the 400s to the 700 or 800s. And this is an example out of history of a ruler that established his dynasty by saying he was of the blood of the reptilians and at the same time of the blood of Christ. And that this, he had these dual bloodlines flowing through his veins. And that is how they maintained their power. And they were both good and evil kings. The Merovingians, for the most part, were very benevolent to their people, their dynasty. But at the same time, they ruled with that iron fist and claimed those bloodlines. And the Merovingian bloodlines is what leads you through the whole Grail bloodlines, the blood of Christ bloodlines, the descendants of Christ that led all the way up into theories that led to the founding of the Thule Society and the Nazi Party. So this is stuff right out of current history, if you will, going back to not as far as biblical or ancient history, but ancient in the sense that it's, it's in the 400s when it was founded. So this is